Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for January 4th, 2024, first show of the big new year. And stepping out on a positive note, if that's possible even these days. But yes, you have to manage the future, otherwise it'll manage you. So anyway, quick announcement. A lot of people have been writing in about the webpage. The J. McCanny Science webpage got royally hacked, and it was backed up, luckily. It's just been somewhat of an effort getting it back put back together. So at any rate, what I have told people in the past is that you should be listening to this show on shortwave if you're relying on the internet, if you're relying on my archive page, if you're relying on some streaming service, then you can have a problem. And now this is why I have maintained my show on shortwave, WWCR, the same time slot for 24 years. I pay for the airtime, and I don't have income other than like the books, water filters I sell, etc., to maintain the web pages, the various web pages. The GMCC water filters page was not hacked. It was the J. McCanny Science page. I must be putting out some information that somebody just doesn't want you to hear, but the point is that I have this show airing on shortwave for a reason, because someday, and that day happens to be right now, that someday the internet is just not going to be there. They're going to pull the plug, and that's it. You're not going to get any information. People are walking around, I always listen to your archive on your webpage. Where is it? Well, you should be listening to this show on a shortwave radio. If you're not, and the internet is not there for you, then boo-hoo you. I don't know what to tell you. You know, I'll get the web page up and running again very shortly, but it happened right before the holidays, so that's a bad time to try and get anything done. So the web page should be up soon, and hopefully with some improvements, things that will be interesting on a daily basis, so people will come back on a daily basis. And that was in the works before, when the web page got earned an early demise. So anyway, okay, so the web page should be back shortly, the J. McCanny Science. With the short URL I use for radio was jmccsci.com. And some people had just linked the radio page. They probably had it in their bookmarks or something. So they would go there and bookmark to the archive page where the radio shows would be kept. And they're simply not there anymore. Also, there was an issue where the developers they created their own web page names. And I told them not to do that, but you know how it is in the world of development. When you tell people to do something, don't expect 100% accuracy on what they do. Anyway, that's enough of that. But yeah, the web page should be back up and running soon. But get a shortwave radio. Excuse me, lost my voice there. Get a shortwave radio that goes down to below 5 megahertz, and because my show is on the 5 point in the 5 point megahertz range, and then the summertime frequency is higher. I think it's in the 9 megahertz range, but a lot of shortwave radios have a lower limit, and so you have to look for that. I would recommend getting a radio that can go down into the 3 megahertz range. There's a lot of good content there. Learn how to use it. It's not hard. It's like dial in, turn it on, turn on the on button. Not too difficult. And then dial in. Go to my webpage and figure out the shortwave summertime, wintertime frequencies. Tune it in and listen. And make a habit of that. And if you don't listen to it all the time, if you depend on my archives most of the time, okay. But get a shortwave radio, because there are times, and they are occurring right now, when my show will not be on the air because of the content. I'm bringing you truthful content. I have been for 20 years, and they don't like that. They don't like you to understand that the Christmas star was a comet. They go to great extent to obliterate any knowledge of the public regarding comets. Very important part of our history and our lives. Okay, so enough of that. But yeah, my page should be back up very soon. Now, here's a topic that I really would never, ever in a million years venture on my radio show, but nobody else is talking about this. And I rarely get to see TV because of my lifestyle and things like that. But I had the rare opportunity to see, and I like watching footballs. I used to coach football. There was a time when I coached football. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about that, but I had some very winning couple teams that I coached and had some very successful players that went on to college, etc. After, you know, but I'm watching these bowl games, and I, you know, college football or pro football, I really don't watch too much. I'm not real impressed with the pros. They get their paycheck anyway. But the college students are there for, you know, because they want to be. Although college football has become big business and big money involved, which is unfortunate. And I'll make a comment here off the cuff that I really don't like where they have staff up in the, you know, the stadium watching the game and calling the plays and looking for the defense. I just let these teams go out there and play, you know, 1 hour of football, 4 15-minute quarters, and let them play. Let the quarterback call the plays as he sees them, as he sees the weaknesses in the defense, and stop this. Anyway, that's not my comment. That's just like an off-the-cuff comment. But here's my question. And if you watch these two last bowl games, they were on like the same day, which was maybe Sunday or something like that. And that was the one game was Michigan State, or Michigan, one of the Michigan big teams, number one in the nation, versus Alabama. Michigan wins last minute. I think that one went into overtime because of a missed extra point. Oh my goodness. Well, was it a bad snap? I think it was a bad snap. Anyway, they missed it. The game would have been over before that, and Michigan would have won by 1 point. But this missed extra point, yeah, it was a bad snap, went over their head. How often does that happen? And they had to fall on the ball, and they missed the extra point. So the score ends up 20-20, and so they have a sudden death playoff. And then the other game was Washington versus Texas, in a very similar situation where it comes down and Texas is bearing down on the goal line, and here's both games ended up with the same situation where the team that was behind is at the goal line ready to make a score, and they call these plays that are not in the end zone. They're like stupid plays. I mean, up the middle. Against Michigan State has the biggest, most formidable line on the planet, and you're trying to run up the gut on a goal line stance. You know, your chances of doing this are about as much a chance that I would have of making a touchdown against that line. You know, you need plays that can, stack up the middle and then run around them or something. Or these plays, like Michigan, had a very good play where they pulled the right end, and he ran across the field, and then one of the other backs, I'm not sure, I don't remember the whole play, but the other back then ran a blocking pattern, and it was just a little flip pass to this guy, and he goes in the end zone for a touchdown, and everybody else was going right. And these two guys went left, and they were wide open, touchdown. You know, those are the kind of plays you need in those crunch times when you got a defense that is hardly is like impenetrable, and on the goal line even worse. So you need special plays. So trying to run up the gut, or even a quarterback's keeper up the gut at the very end, it's like, what are you doing? You know? So my read on this, because in the case with in the overtime, which was the Michigan-Alabama game, they had four plays to make a touchdown. They go start at the 25-yard line in sudden death overtime. Michigan made its touchdown right away with the extra point. So Alabama is okay. They got to score a touchdown and extra point to keep it tied, to keep the game going. But Alabama calls these plays that are stupid. I mean, and I, like I say, I coach football, and I would have recognized, okay, this is where you pull the rabbit out of the hat. You got to have a trick play, not a flea flicker, but a really solid play that's going to make a touchdown every time, 100% of the time. And it's something that, you set up the play, you have the flow going one way, and one guy goes the other way out of the pack, kind of out of nowhere. And so anyway, the point is that the losing team in both of these games was pressing to the goal line and should have won. Both the Texas should have won against Washington. They were right there on the goal line. They couldn't make a touchdown in four plays, right on the goal line. And the same with Alabama against Michigan. And I've been wondering about this for a long time, because let's look at, say, Ohio State games. Huge amounts of betting on these games because they have this amazing following. And then losing games to really bad teams, like in bowl games or in games leading up to the finale of the season, and losing a game with really stupid calls. And I've started thinking, there's too much money involved here. The betting, especially the betting that goes on in some of these sports games, the amount of betting, and if you could somehow fix it. Now, my question is, are college football games fixed? Are there teams that are going out there and losing? And I mean, it would be difficult because you have all these different players, you have the coaches, you have, who would be in a position to fix a game? You have the referees, they look like they're doing a good job, an honest job. But, all it takes is one critical play and it changes the whole game. Somebody is driving, they get stopped, there's a penalty. Or you mix a number of these things together and one team loses. And so I'm, because of the bizarre nature of the calls, the play calling at the end of both of these games, I'm like, this is not the kind of plays you would call. You're on the goal line, you're pressing, you got to make a touchdown. Like I say, that's when you got to pull the rabbit out of the hat. You got to have a play that is 100% touchdown, gonna make it. And the fact that they make these plays that have almost zero chance of success four in a row, it's like, wait a minute, buddy. And the fans are up in the stands aghast, because they know that their team can score. They've watched them all season. They've come down to the wire. They're in the pinch, these teams are really good. The quarterbacks, the players, the receivers, the runners, these are all American people, all American athletes. And of course, they're against the defense, very good defenses, but still, it's the play calling that I'm talking about here. You have these great, amazing players, and then to call, a run up the middle four times, what? What are you doing? So at any rate, my question, and it's and it's a would be pretty controversial. I've thrown this out amongst people who are big college fans. They got their team, they followed them forever, etc. And boy, you just can't cross that line with people. They don't even want to consider it. They don't even want to give it, a New York second time a day. But is college football, once you get up to these big games, are they fixed? Is the fix in? And there's just too much money involved. Okay, so I'm not going to dwell on that anymore. But in watching these two games and seeing that same outcome at the end, where the other team is down there and really with four downs should have been able to score, and with good plays calling, good play calling, but to call plays that just don't have a chance of making it four times in a row, it's like, no. This is not, something's amiss here. Okay, enough of that. Tonight, my main science topic, I want to talk about the Kuiper Belt. And this comes from an article that I read and was in a phys.org, phys.org magazine. And I think it was there was another article very similar in Universe. I think it was like universe.com or something like that. But anyway, the Kuiper Belt is a region outside of Pluto. Actually, it starts with the planet Pluto, and yes, Pluto is a planet. And it's a region in which thousands and thousands of planets have been discovered with automated search engines. This started back, oh, I don't remember when the first one was started. The first one was discovered. It was called Sedna, discovered by an automated search. The guy named Michael Brown was a grad student at the time. I'm sure he's become a professor somewhere working on these automated search programs, and they discover this planet called Sedna. And I could probably make a wild guess as to when this was, because it was about the same time that I was giving an invited talk to the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, to the USO, to UFO Congress. So this would be around 2003 when Sedna, the first exoplanet of our solar system, an exoplanet is a planet not in our solar system. But these planets really are part of our solar system. But then they started finding more and more and more, and that's when they demoted Pluto from being a planet because they had a little problem. This was in the midst of the, I mean, at the peak of the Planet X hysteria, 2003. And so the last thing they needed was somebody to discover a planet, the 10th planet, and that's what they did. So instead of discovering the 10th planet, if they demoted Pluto from being the 9th planet to not being a planet, then the new discovery would be Planet 9, even though it was smaller than Pluto. So then they changed the definition of planet to mean something that sweeps out the region of space gravitationally. In other words, clears out items, either brings them into the planet or throws them out, thus clearing a path, so to speak, in the orbital path of the planet. And it's a strange definition because if you took Earth and put it out to where Pluto is, Earth would no longer be a planet. And if you took Pluto and brought it into where Earth is, it would be a planet. So it's a really bizarre definition. But it was contrived to fit the narrative that Pluto cannot be a planet. They had to make up some rule. It's kind of like when kids are playing sandlot baseball, and there's always one kid that's losing. So he makes up a rule, some kind of special rule that allows him to win. one of those deals, something little kids do. But anyway, okay, back to the idea that Sedna is discovered. So all of a sudden they start discovering hundreds of these planets and then thousands, and then they discover some big ones. And then it just kind of like goes quiet. on the science news scene because they're going, wait a minute, there's Jupiter-sized planets out there going around the sun in these really, really slow orbits, and they probably take many, many thousands of years, if not hundreds of thousands of years, to orbit the sun. And so, anyway, recently there was an article about Kuiper Belt objects and about the search for them and kind of a discussion of what's the current state of knowledge, etc., in the popular press, which stemmed from a journal article in the Astrophysical Journal, which is kind of a, it's a peer-reviewed journal. So anyway, the question is, where do these things come from, these thousands of other planets, and why are they there? How'd they get there? And what's going to happen to them? What's the future for these planets in the Kuiper Belt? So the Kuiper Belt is simply this region where they considered there were small planets, but like I say, now they're finding big planets and probably even many solar systems out there where big planets, Jupiter-sized objects, have an array of family of members around it. And like I say, things move very, very slowly out there. So anyway, the article talks about a couple possibilities. Well, where do these things come from? And they've defined a term that's called FFPs, free floating planets. In other words, they're just out there. They're just out there. But see, they're in orbit around the sun. This is a belt of planets, kind of like the asteroid belt that has thousands of chunks of rock orbiting the sun. Where did those come from? Was it a planetary collision? Was it just a space there where things can collect because there's no planet there? What exactly, where did the asteroid come from? And it's probably a combination of both of those things. But anyway, back out to the Kuiper Belt. Where did these things come from? So anyway, these astronomers say they probably were not part of our solar system, maybe a few of them. And then they say, well, these were then thrown out of our solar system by the existing planets. But that doesn't make a lot of sense because if they were thrown out of the solar system, then they would be on an elliptical orbit and they would come back into the solar system, unless they had enough zip to where they completely escaped the sun's gravitational field, in which case they would then be out in intergalactic space between the stars. But here's the problem. Here's the whole problem. When they're zipping through space and say they eventually encounter another star, there's nothing in outer space. There's no drag. There's no drag of any kind because there's nothing out there. If you look from planet Earth down here on the surface, you get a nice telescope, big professional grade telescope, and you look through our atmosphere and then out into outer space to the other side of the universe. I mean, as far as you can see, hundreds of thousands, millions, billions of light years away, which is really far, there's more material in our atmosphere between you and that object, that distant object. There is more material in our atmosphere than there is in all of outer space, the rest of outer space, for those 13 billion light years distance to the other place. So the space is empty. I mean, it is really, really empty out there. And so there's really nothing to drag on these objects. So here's the situation. If they're coming in like a bullet, if they have overcome the gravitational well of the alleged star that they came from, then they have a lot of velocity. They have a lot of energy, and so then they start falling down into the gravitational well of our star, the sun. And when they start coming into here, they got some serious velocity going on. And then the question is, well, why would they stay with our sun? And they really wouldn't. They would just whip around our sun. They would use the gravitational field of the sun to reverse or change their direction, and then they would zip out and be gone because they come in with such high velocity because they're coming from some other star system. So that doesn't work. That doesn't work. And so, how do you capture something into a solar system? And this goes back to work I did when I was at Cornell. And this problem was solved back then by a group of astronomers. And the main contributor to this, his name was TJJC. I talk about him in my three-part comet paper that's in the appendix of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. But him and another guy named Darwin, who was actually related to Charles Darwin, I think it was like a nephew or an offspring of Charles Darwin. They did calculations and to understand the process of capture. So they developed the first capture system of solar system development, saying, "Hey, these planets out here are captured." And but it depended on one thing. It depended on the resisting medium. In other words, enough matter in outer space that would slow down these objects, causing them to reduce their orbits. But it was soon discovered that there's really nothing out there. Like I say, there's you can look through the atmosphere, and if you look all the way to distant stars or galaxies, there's nothing. There's less material between the top of our atmosphere in those objects than there is in all of our atmosphere. So not a lot, not a lot of material in outer space, certainly not enough to affect or cause this drag that was needed to circularize orbits and reduce orbits as part of the capture process. Okay, so anyway, when I read that, I was working on my comet work and realized that it was the tail drag of the comet because the tail material was coming into the comet nucleus, creating a drag and building up mass, and that caused a drag on the comet nucleus, which was the bigger ones becoming planets. And so that's where I developed the plasma discharge comet model and the creation of solar systems. And that's really the emphasis of my first publication, my first book. When I was at Cornell, it was called Comet Capture Processes in the Formation of Solar Systems. So, talking about comets being captured and then becoming planets. And of course, that's what got me in trouble because it was right on the heels of Velikovsky being defamed for talking about the same thing, but from a humanistic point of view, from looking at ancient texts. And realizing that the ancients were talking about this, especially in the case of planet Venus, that Venus had been a large comet and that it had careened through the solar system, causing great damage to Earth on two different occasions, and then eventually settled into what we know as the planet Venus today. So, back to the topic of capture. Now, here's the crux of the issue. So, I'll give you just a little forewarning of where all this is going. All of these planets that are in the Kuiper Belt, this region outside of Pluto, so it's a big, big region outside of Pluto. And like, to give you an example, an astronomical unit in astronomy is the distance from Earth to the Sun. And it's an average distance, you know, because Earth's distance to the Sun varies during the year a little bit. But it's the average distance from Earth to the Sun. So that's like a measure of distance in outer space. Pluto, little Pluto out there, is about 39 astronomical units from the Sun. And of course, that varies also. And it's not in a perfectly in a perfect orbit in the plane of the rest of the planets. It's somewhat of a skew. So anyway, that gives you an idea where this Kuiper Belt starts. It's about 40 times the distance of Earth to the Sun, and then it just goes way out there. In fact, I'm sure it goes very, very far out beyond what we even consider today to be the outer limit. And things move very slowly out there, but these things are in orbit around the Sun. So the question is, the $24, the $64,000 question is, how did these things get there? And so since it doesn't fit into the original theory of solar system development that has been developed by astronomers, and this is why they have to be, kind of treat this as a special group, not really talk about it, is because if a planet were formed in some other solar system and thrown out, and then came to our solar system, it would be going so fast by the time it was falling into our sun's gravitational field that it would simply zip out, go around the sun, zip out, and with very, very low probability of encountering any of the other planets or major objects in the solar system, and just head back out on its way and never be seen again. So it would be a one-time, potentially bright comet that might last for a few days or a few months, maybe like Hale-Bopp or something like that. But Hale-Bopp was a member of our solar system. It's in a closed elliptical orbit with a period, original orbital period of around 4,200 years, and now an orbital period of a couple thousand years. It cut its orbit in half with one passage of the sun. And that is because of the tail drag, the drag of the tail of the comet on the nucleus. And so it's building up matter at a tremendous rate, becoming a planet. Okay, so at any rate, back to these Kuiper Belt objects. Here is the process of capture. Now, an object coming in at high rate, high speed, would, if it came in on the correct path, it could interact with a planet like, say, Jupiter or Saturn or Uranus or Neptune or even Earth. But what happens is in that gravitational interaction, because it's a two-body system, the Earth and the Sun, Jupiter and the Sun, Saturn and the Sun, whatever the combination, it would reduce the energy of this object in orbit coming in from who knows where. Captured into our solar system. But there's a problem here, because if that happens, then necessarily the orbit of that object as it is coming into our solar system is captured. The inside edge of that orbit would be well within our solar system, the known nine planets, because once that object leaves the gravitational well of the planet that's capturing it, then its orbit is fixed in the inner solar system, and the rest of the orbit probably goes way out of the solar system, but it's a captured object. At that point, it's not going to go out into intergalactic space and go away and never come back. So the point is that these objects out in the Kuiper Belt could not have come from capture. And there, it's very interesting in the articles, these guys must know that that's the case, because gravity is very well understood. And so if they said these objects were captured, then they'd have to admit that there could be something like a Planet X object that comes in, wreaks havoc with Earth, and then leaves. That's just the reality of life. Or the other possibility is that these guys have no clue about the capture processes in gravity and in astronomy and have no idea what they're doing. But I think the capture is a basic commodity, I think is a basic a piece of knowledge that most of these people should have. By the way, it's used in reverse to fling spacecraft out into the outer solar system, where, for example, the Voyager spacecraft went around Jupiter, picked up energy instead of losing energy and becoming captured. It used the reverse of that process, gravitational process, and there again, it depends on Jupiter and the Sun, two gravitational bodies working together. And if you don't have the two gravitational bodies working together, then capture simply does not happen. Object would come in, swing around it, regain all of its energy, and be gone forever. Okay, the the question once again, how did these objects get out there? And what is very clear to me is that this is also a region of what I call the nebular ion cloud, when you have the fusion in the solar atmosphere, not in the core, but in the solar atmosphere, and the distribution of charge, the separation of charge, and then the acceleration through the electron sheath that surrounds the sun, you end up with a very high flow rate of protons. Protons leaving the sun and heading out and sweeping out dust and gases in the inner solar system to hold them at bay out in this region outside of Pluto. So there's a couple things going on here. One is the sweeping of material out from the inner solar system by the solar wind. And number two, the creation of a capacitor in also in this process. So the nebular ion cloud is the positive side of this capacitor, and the sun is the negative side of the capacitor. So all of these objects out in the Kuiper belt are discharging the solar capacitor. They're acting as comets and dragging in dust and material that's out in that nebular ion cloud, slowly working their way into the solar system, potentially taking millions, if potentially billions of years. We don't know. We don't know the history of these objects because the history of man only goes back so far, a couple thousand years.
Actually, the history of man goes back much farther than that, but our knowledge of related to these objects out there, we really don't have scientific information that's been passed down, although it existed. There were very advanced civilizations on planet Earth, possibly dozens, possibly hundreds of them that developed and then went away over the eons and eons. Man is a much older being. I don't like the word species because it really has too many bad connotations. It implies evolution. But man goes back in his current state, man goes back tens, hundreds of thousands of years or more that we know about. Okay, but like I say, in that time span, we don't have any knowledge of these Kuiper belt objects from the history of man. There's nobody in the history of man that was writing about Kuiper belt objects. It's just something that to our knowledge is a recent discovery and only known about by modern man, although it may have been known about by previous civilizations that were very advanced. We don't know, but there's no record of it. Okay, so anyway, there's a series of very complicated activities going on here that contribute to the well-being and development of these planetary objects in the Kuiper belt. And of course, looking at what NASA knows, they don't know about the nebular ion clouds, not in their vocabulary. They don't understand that, by the way, that happens to be what the Big Bang people are looking at when they see the microwave background radiation, microwave signal from outer space. What they're looking at is this nebular ion cloud. And unless they get outside of that and look beyond that, that's what they're going to see, and they're going to interpret that as being the background radiation from the Big Bang, which it is not. It's a nebular ion cloud which surrounds our star, and you can see these around our neighboring stars. All our neighboring stars have them too. It's a ring of material. And back in my early work, I called it the nebular ion cloud or donut-shaped nebular ion cloud also. Okay. So these objects are then orbiting in this region, discharging the solar capacitor, and you can see them. I have photographs of, like, the say the Eskimo Nebula, and there's many, many famous nebulae that are around neighboring stars, and you can see the comets in that nebular ion region which surrounds these stars. So it's like a star surrounded by this colorful nebular ion cloud, and you can see the comets, these big planets forming in there. You can't see the planets because they would be just microscopically small on that scale. Although on the scale of the solar system,
They're the size of planets, and they're developing, and some of them have gotten big. So these things are growing and growing and growing, slowly, ever so slowly, orbiting inwards, because the tail drag causes energy loss, loss of velocity, and that causes these objects to fall into lower and lower orbits. But the point is, number one, they were never captured as such. They were not captured as planets because, like I said, if they came from someplace else where they allegedly developed, and this is always the problem with these theories that come up from standard sciences, because they don't, if it came from another solar system, well, then how did they get out of that solar system, and to the point where there's thousands and thousands of times the number of these Kuiper type objects than there are of regular planets. So these planetary systems would have to be pumping these things out like Johnny B. Goode, and that's just it's the other way around. Objects are being captured into the solar system, not being thrown out. But also, the development occurs in the solar system with the comet capture process, the discharge of the solar capacitor, and the very important discovery that I made is the tail drag. And so this completes the work of TJJC in Darwin. The concept of capture being the main process for the development of solar systems, because what they were trying to look at was the resisting medium, which doesn't exist. But if you take and discharge that solar capacitor and you have this big comet tail that's being dragged into the nucleus, now all of a sudden you have the resisting medium back and very much alive in the theoretical world. Okay, so now that explains where the Kuiper Belt objects come from. And there are thousands of them. So then eventually these objects can come orbiting inwards very slowly, and Pluto is one of those. But this process takes a very long time. And so then the question becomes, if our solar system was formed by capture, then of all of these various objects, then the age of the solar system is kind of a vacuous question, because there's no single age of the solar system, because it started with just the Sun and Jupiter as the original star pair, capturing all of these objects, all of them at a later date, one by one. So there's really no birth time frame for the entire solar system, because it didn't happen all at once. Like standard science says, oh, 4.5 billion years ago, the solar system formed. Well, there's absolutely no experimental evidence for that. If you pick up a rock on Earth or you pick up a rock on the moon, it has nothing to do with the age of the moon or the Earth, because its surface, the real core part of the Earth or the real core part of the moon, nobody's ever seen them. Nobody's ever gotten near them. Nobody ever, in our even wildest imaginations, we're not going to be able to drill. Look at on Earth, you can drill down a few miles, to get oil, but it's really it doesn't give you a lot of knowledge about what's really down in the core of Earth. We have no idea what's down there, where it came from, or how old it is, or when it originally got here. We have no knowledge at all. So for scientists to somehow say they know the age of the solar system is bizarre. The what they should say is, we don't know and we can't know. There's no way to measure it. There's no way to get data on the original formation part of planet Earth. And it's certainly not related to something you pick up on the surface. Good grief. I mean, that's just basic 101 kindergarten science. So getting back to a summary here, to summarize what we know, these objects could not possibly have come from somewhere else. Maybe a seed item, or maybe a very small piece of something that was the original seed of one of these objects. But They did not come from someplace else. So the idea that these are being formed someplace else, and even that begs the question, like I say, how could all of these objects be forming somewhere else and then be thrown out and then end up in our solar system? The cross section of our solar system is really small, even if you go way out there, 1,000 AU. The size of that in outer space is just minuscule. And so if our solar system has captured thousands of these, there'd have to be trillions of these floating all over outer space. Many hundreds of thousands, millions of times more of these objects than are in solar systems captured or are in orbits around the various stars in the galaxy. So it doesn't make any sense to imagine that somehow these things arrived from someplace else and got captured. And besides, even if you made that theoretical proposition, there would be no way to prove it because our telescope technology just isn't able to see beyond this Kuiper Belt region. It's just not there. So it would be a theory that has no ability to be proven, just like the Oort cloud, this alleged cloud of comets that exists way out 100,000 astronomical units from the sun. Well, nobody's ever going to measure it. You can't see it. These comets would have to be little. So you're never going to be able to prove or disprove it. Either way, doesn't matter. Yet the textbooks are filled with this concept of the Oort cloud. This Scandinavian physicist who said, well, it was very interesting physics at the time. What they did is they studied the outer edge of comet orbits. And they said, well, it seems that these things don't come in the vast majority statistically. The vast majority of these comets come from a limited distance, not from infinity. They come from a limited distance, and this is about where they would be, their outer, the outer distance of their elliptical orbit. And so it would make sense to think that, oh, there's a source of these things out there. So, I mean, in its day, that was a very good piece of physics, making an estimate. But really, what the end result was, the reason this appears this way is because comets, which are just any object coming in that discharges a solar capacitor, as they come in, the tail drag slows them down, which gives it the appearance that they came from a limited distance. And that's because of the tail drag. So it's an effect of the tail drag on all comets that slows them down and gives them the appearance that they all come from some limited region out there, which in back in the day of Oort, of course, he didn't know about the plasma discharge comet model, tail drag, or any of that. In fact, astronomers still don't know about that because they're too ignorant to realize that the theories they're proposing just make no sense. So there's got to be a better explanation somewhere. But of course, they can't cross that line because they're tier two scientists. And what's even more bizarre about this whole thing is that you listen to my radio show, I pay for my airtime, and you have to listen to this show to find out what's really going on in the theoretical astronomy. Now back to this name. I find this rather a bizarre name here, the one that the astronomers are calling these objects, FFL, no, FF, I'm sorry, FFPs, free floating planets. And it's like they're just floating out there all by themselves, and free floating. Just the implication is they're just there. They just, of course. The supposedly all the nine planets on the inner solar system formed in this swirling cloud of dust and gas, and all had to form at one time and did so within a very short period of time, 4.5 billion years ago. But these thousands of objects out there, which none of them could have formed in our solar system, because they would still have remnants of those orbits within our solar system, to just call them free floating planets, like, oh, they're just there floating around. That to me is bizarre. That is like the ultimate in name dropping, that they just have no clue. Why don't they just call them the no clue planets? That we have no clue planets. That's what they should call them. That should be the mnemonic for the Kuiper Belt objects. But now, here's another thing that's very interesting, is that there's clear evidence of very large objects out there, potentially much larger than Jupiter. And so these would be objects that are physically large but cold, whereas Jupiter still has heat being generated from fusion in its atmosphere, the same with Saturn. But these objects out in the Kuiper Belt, you would, I mean, they're very cold objects. So, kind of like Pluto, when they got close to Pluto, which is a now considered a Kuiper Belt object. The closest of the Kuiper Belt objects is Pluto. It was raining ammonia. Ammonia was coming into the atmosphere, and literally, and not in the form of rain, but in the form of snow, crystalline ammonia. And so, I mean, very, very cold conditions, a couple hundred degrees below zero in the atmosphere, and really not a lot of atmosphere because it just freezes and drops. It crystallizes, and so there's really not a lot of atmosphere. But when you look at it, Pluto from a distance, there is atmosphere, and that's because this material is being drawn in, the hydrogens and the nitrogens, etc. And here's another very interesting point that's finally coming out in the peer-reviewed journals, is that electric fields enhance chemical reactions. When I was taking physical chemistry in college, there was a thing that I was studying. It was called rates of reaction. In other words, if you take two chemical species and they naturally combine, or you need to push them with a bit more energy over the energy threshold to make them combine, there's a whole science involved in that. But if you put them in an electric field, the threshold for formation of these chemicals goes down. In other words, it's easier for them to form. And just guess what a comet does? Isn't that special? It forms an electric field, and when the materials come in, the raw atomic species or small molecular species, the single oxygen, the double oxygen, the hydrogen, the single molecule hydrogen, and these things start combining. You get H2O water. That's one of the more basic ones because we have an abundance of water in comet tails. That tells us there's a lot of free hydrogen and free oxygen out there in outer space. And this is the kind of nebulous gas that really does not block the vision of, say, galaxies far away. And so space does have material in it, but it's very vacuous, extremely vacuous. But when the comet process is working and these materials are being drawn into towards the comet nucleus, they join, and their threshold for formation is greatly reduced. That's very interesting. What that tells us, that comets are basically breeding grounds for larger chemicals. So that's why you see in comet tails the hydrocarbons, the nitrogen hydrogen carbons, the hydrogen compounds are with water, with carbon, with nitrogen, with other atomic species. And those form the, for example, water and the various forms of water, the hydrogen concarbon, so you get the hydrocarbons, the oils, everything from benzene all the way up to the long chain heavy oils that came raining in. Remember the ancients, the talking about the oils, the burning naphtha that came in, rained and burnt their skin as it rained down from above. You know, where does burning oil come from in the atmosphere? Well, it comes from outer space, from Earth passing through the tail of a comet. And then you have the gaseous, the noxious gases, the ammonia compounds, ammonia, the nitrogen hydrogen compounds, all of these formed in comet tails. So there was a study that just came out recently talking about an entire mass extinction on Earth, and this was back when there were just like shells and very very primitive life forms. That the entire mass extinction was due to very foul gases in the atmosphere. Well, Earth didn't just jump up and do that all by itself one day. No, this was because of a passing comet. So the mass extinctions, the big events in Earth's history, the Noah's flood, the Moses event when Venus was coming by, causing the Earth to rock and roll, the Mayans talk about that, Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart became the planet Venus, from the Popol Vuh, the Mayas. All of these events were caused by comets. And that is why the world masters that control the news media and the oil industry and everything else keep this secret. That's one of the best kept secrets that I've blown the cover on, of course. Because comets are an essential part of our history, an essential part of the geology, the makeup of planet Earth, and everything that went to make planet Earth is all related to comets. And then you get to the Christmas star, other events in man's history and Earth's history related to comets. Okay, I'm about out of time here. I got a minute and a half left, so I'm going to talk a little bit about water filters. There is a sale on the web page. It's put there. And later tonight, I will be my monthly appearance on the Jeff Rentz show. Of course, yesterday morning, I was on the John Moore show. I'm there every week, Wednesday mornings, 8 a.m. Central Time. Tonight, 9 a.m. Central Time, Jeff Rentz. I'm the monthly guest there. And I put up a sale on the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. The best deal, which is the MR5 whole house water filter, the UV sterilizer, and the extra pack of filter elements for the MR5, we call it the best deal. Normally $19.80, now at $15.80, so $400 off. And if you use the coupon code JMCC, you get another 5% off and free shipping. So if you've been sitting on the fence thinking about getting a whole house water filter, now is the time. After I didn't have any sales over the Christmas, or after Thanksgiving, no sales at all. But go there now, all the information, jmccwaterfilters.com, and I'll talk to you on the Jeff Rentz show in a couple of hours. This is James McCanney. This is my science hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.